All that summer heat, we spend the entire summer season sending all that heat underground, right? As we said, 250 meters, by the way, that's half of a CN tower down. So although it's not deep, it's deep. The amazing thing is that we take all that summer heat and it's stored, right? So it's stored in that rock as a big thermal battery, as Catherine mentioned. And then in the winter, yes, we literally reverse the system, send cold water down, bring that very same heat that we saved in the summer back up to heat the buildings.
What kind of rock is that?
It's actually limestone. If you go deep enough, you can actually see we have a demonstration here of part of our display to educate people. We actually have the sense of from the ground surface, we start with clay, sand, gravel, then we go down to shale, and then really the prime thermal battery rock perspective is basically limestone.
There's a lot of limestone down there.
Yep, it's very much. Anything from 160 meters down is basically limestone.
The fact that King's College Circle is just such a large green space and a remarkable urban location where students walk and pedestrians, people, Torontonians come and walk around King's College Circle, and people come for concerts at Convocation Hall. Mm-hmm. And it's just this big space. And at some point somebody said, hey, you know, like, why don't we build this geo exchange system right beneath this circle, and there's a parking garage down there.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like, it's just, whose idea was that to say, hey, why don't we do this beneath King's College Circle?
You know, it's such an interesting story because you're talking about the surface above us, the green space, right? So previously, not 4 or 5 years ago, before we did our landmark, we basically redid our entire landmark project, the King's College Circle itself. We removed the cars from the surface. Now we have the parking garage underneath. So we restored that space back to where the way it was back in the early 1900s, where there was no cars, it was just people. So we restored that pedestrian space. And so jump forward to, let's say, 2015, 2016, the university thought, well, if we're going to do a geo-exchange system, where should we put it? That was how the decision was made.
And there was a parking garage beneath King's College Circle at that point?
Nope. The parking garage was part of redoing the surface area so that we can get the cars off that pedestrian space and move them underground. And then at the same time, well, in fact, the geo-exchange system was first, and we said, well, if we're going to build that system, we might as well put one level of parking to support.
And here's the parking garage.
That's right, in the parking garage here, and you can see if you look straight ahead, we're talking about 150 meters, roughly. This mechanical room that supports this geo-exchange system runs the entire length of this parking garage. As Catherine mentioned earlier, everywhere where you see a vehicle in front of you, every 15-foot centers, there is a borehole, 372 in total, that go that 250 meters down. So people are walking on a thermal battery when they get into their car, and we want to make sure that when they come to this garage, they get that experience, they understand that's the case.
And are there electric charging stations in there?
There absolutely is. We actually have 48 level 2 charging stations, your standard sort of public stations.
For charging electric cars?
For charging EVs, and that is out of 236 spots. So it's a vast, you know, a very, very good chunk of the total parking spots. And we also have level 3 charging. It's actually a battery buffered level 3 charging, the first of its kind in the world, actually. The technology was developed here at the University of Toronto. We have two chargers that are actually in the garage here too as well. So another example of sort of demonstrating to the public that it can be done.
How many people come down here, especially students, and they say, it gets people excited. It gets people creative. And they think, you know, in this world, there's so much pessimism and woe about the prospects for, you know, combating climate change. We're heading towards, you know, we're breaking past 1.5 degrees, we're heading towards 2.8 or 3 degrees, which is kind of like a catastrophe. But you come down to a space like this and you think, wow, it really is possible to do things in really creative ways that are, you know, that actually achieve greenhouse gas emission reductions, but are also kind of cool.
Yeah, and I think what's so inspiring is that at the end of the day, our mission is to make sure that students come to this campus and maybe more importantly leave this campus with that sense of, you know what, University of Toronto cares about sustainability, and I believe there's a chance. I know we can make effective change. We want them to be excited about it. We want to start when their very, very first class to give them that sort of injection of sustainability and have them leave and go out into the world with that positivity that it can be done. You just have to have the will and do it.
Scott Hendershot is Senior Manager of the Sustainability Office at the University of Toronto. Catherine Thorne is the U of T's Director of Sustainability and Energy Management. Read more about the geo-exchange system beneath King's College Circle at the St. George campus of the U of T at greenplanetmonitor.net. Totally different way to cut greenhouse gas emissions using water, fresh and salty water to be specific. Salinity gradient power, it's called. Wherever fresh river water flows into salty seas, control that flow. Force fresh and salty water across ion selective membranes. Cations go one way, anions go another. Set up electrodes on either end. You generate electricity. That's precisely what people have been doing in the Netherlands. In the middle of a long dike separating North Holland from Friesland, the Afsluit Dike, it's called. Check it out on a map. Fresh water from the inland IJsselmeer is combined with salt water from the North Sea. Red Stack is the first operating facility of this sort in the world. RED stands for Reverse Electrodialysis. Now paused, Red Stack's pilot plant has the capacity to produce 1 kilowatt of electricity. Not very much, but scaling up will be easy. Having proved it works under all conditions, the next step will be to build larger membrane stacks. A 2-megawatt demonstration facility could be up and running in a couple of years. Peter Hack is co-founder and chair of Red Stack.
When you look at a membrane stack, basically it's something like this. It's a water inlet, a water outlet. And if you take in fresh water, salt water, of course, you have 2 water inlets. There is a connection for the power connection, and that's it. And from the outside, it's just a tube with some connections. On the inside is where all the membranes are. And this one is using square membranes stacked in a pile, maybe even some 1,000 membranes inside. And the outside, you only see the tube. So it's not moving, it's not making a sound, it's just simple tube like you are seeing here. The official name is reversed electrodialysis. That means reverse. You do something in the other way around. And basically it is the reverse of electrodialysis. It's the reverse of an existing seawater desalination technology. So we took the same equipment, but operated in the other way around. And such equipment is built up of a pile, a stack of membranes. And there are 2 types of membranes in it, alternately stacked. One membrane is suitable for passing the positive salts from the water. The other type of membrane is suitable for passing the negative ions in the water, so chloride, sulfate. And you stack them alternately, and then you guide the fresh water, the salt water, the fresh water, the salt water in parallel in between these membranes. And what happens then is that the salt from the salt water wants to homogenize, go into the fresh water. That's a natural phenomenon, a natural law. But when the salt water, the positive ions want to go to the fresh water, they only can pass through the one membrane suitable for passing for them. They move from salt to fresh. The negative ions, the chlorides, also want to move through the fresh, but they have to go in the other direction, through the other membrane, the opposite membrane from the salt to the fresh. So all the positives go one membrane to the left, all the negatives go one membrane to the right. So then you create a plus and a minus, and that looks like a battery. Then you can harvest some power. Per membrane, we're creating only 50 millivolts. When we work with seawater and river water, it's only 50 millivolts potential you generate per membrane. That's peanuts, but when you stack 1,000 membranes in parallel on a stack, on a pile, then you end up with 50 volts DC. And if you make 2,000 membranes in a stack, you end up with 100 volts DC. And at the outer ends of the stack are electrodes, and they convert the voltage into amps, into power, and then you have a power. And as long as the water continues flowing, the fresh water and salt water continues flowing between the membranes, refreshing, then you have a continuous potential, you have a continuous source of power. Two numbers to remember. What is how much can you harvest per square meter of membrane, which is in a stack, and that is when you talk about river water, seawater, then you can harvest about 2 watts per square meter of membrane. That's the one thing to remember. The other thing to remember is per cubic meter per second a flow of river water, so 1 cubic meter per second of fresh water flowing into the sea, can harvest 1 megawatt. It's a bit depending on the temperature of the seawater, the salinity, but for as a rule of thumb, 1 cubic meter per second of river water flowing into the sea will generate 1 megawatt. A bit of a decent river is 300, 500, 1,000, 3,000, or even more cubic meters per second. So, for example, here in the Netherlands, in Rotterdam, where the River Rhine and Meuse flow into the sea, there the average is more than 3,000 cubic meters per second, but even at low water level, at the dry season, there still is going 1,500 cubic meters per second of river water out into the sea, so that would mean it could be a 1,500 megawatt plant over there. At the Afsluitdijk, where we built a very, very first pilot plant worldwide, developing this technology, we did not build it for its capacity. We built it as it is the first one getting out of the laboratory into the real man's world, in the real world. So at the moment, the capacity there is about 1 kilowatt only. But we think it's more important that at that site, the whole process flow is there. So from water intake from the freshwater side, the pre-treatment, the water intake from the saltwater side, the pretreatment, the membrane stack for harvesting the power, even converting it into AC, and basically also we can supply back into the grid. But for the time being, we don't mind about the capacity. It was small. It was the first in the world, which is more important.
The first in the world.
Yeah. And still is the biggest in the world for this technology. Although we are now planning to expand the capacity. But then we better talk about the size of the membrane stack when we talk about expanding the capacity. When we started the work, we started with a very small membrane stack. It was a membrane stack with only 1/4 of a square meter of membrane in it. And when we built our pilot plant, so using the real water, the surface water, we started with the same size of stacks, only 1/4 of a square meter of membrane in one membrane stack, so very small capacity. But during the course of the years, we increased the size of the stack 1,000 times, and we are now working with stacks with 250 square meters of membrane in one membrane module and one stack. The next step is that we will make it one size bigger. That's the upcoming project. We will go from 250 square meters of membrane in one module into 2,000 square meters of membrane in the bit bigger module. And that will be the final end product. Then we have a membrane stack, a unit, a key component, that is ready for industrial practical use. Further upscaling in size of the module is not needed. We will simply have to make many, many, many of these modules to build megawatts or hundreds megawatts scales plant. Yeah, but first of all, we like where the seawater is really salty and the river water is really fresh. And where the temperature is a bit higher, because then all the chemical and the physical processes go faster, so it's easier and more efficient to harvest this power. So then you look at the warmer areas in the world and where the rivers are, and especially where infrastructural constructions are needed, flood protection systems, because such a blue energy plant best can be integrated in a flood protection system. Like in the Netherlands, we would have the Afsluitdijk or a pumping station or any other type of flood protection system or sluices. There are the places to be. And with the rising sea level worldwide, well, for the upcoming decennia, there will be more and more flood protection systems needed, whilst the river water still has to be out, has to get out. So whenever you would close off a delta with a flood protection system, the river water still has to be emptied into the sea. And then instead of using a traditional pumping station, it's more convenient, more clever, to use our blue energy power plant. And then you have a pumping station that is generating power, because we have to pump the water anyhow through our system. So, but when you design the pumps in such a way that you lift the water 3 or 5 or 8 meter up, so then you can pump with the same system, you can pump the water from the low freshwater side to the high saltwater side. And then you have a power generating pumping system in a flood protection system. And then this flood protection system probably would have a negative power consumption, so a power generating flood protection system. On the Netherlands scale, that is reported by Dutch research organization TNO. It's reported to the Dutch Ministry of Energy, and they state that it will be 1,750 megawatts full continuous sustainable power. Reverse electrodialysis, when it's called blue energy, is reverse electrodialysis only. So we can do 1,750 megawatts, which is comparable to 3 normal size coal power plants or bigger than a decent big nuclear power plant. And that would be 10 to 12% of the Dutch power demand. When you go to a worldwide scale, there are several institutes who have calculated the worldwide potential. And the results from these estimates or calculations go from the lowest one, 600 gigawatt full continuous. And the highest one, if I remember well, was 3.3 terawatt full continuous. So we say 1 terawatt full continuous energy reverse electrodialysis would be the world potential. And then it's depending on what the electricity consumption will be in the future. If we shift away from oil and gas and coal and all go electric, whatever, then we still could call it 10 to 12% of the world power consumption could be generated by reverse electrodialysis. The main benefit is that, opposite to sun and wind, blue energy reverse electrodialysis is full continuous. When you have sun and wind, but there is no sun and no wind, you have no power. So you would need additional conversion and storage systems to make sure that you can supply power 24 hours per day to the grid. When we mention blue energy power plants, as I just mentioned, full continuous, then you don't need any storage, no conversions, you have just full baseload, full continuous availability.
What excites you about this the most? And when you meet people who you're explaining this to, people who are venture capitalists or government people or whoever who are planning their strategies for rollout of renewable energy and decarbonization, and you tell them about reverse electrodialysis, what is it that excites them the most?
Well, that is, on the one hand side, it fits with the Dutch guys. We are good in water management, water technology, so we have a relationship with water and we understand water. So for the Dutch guys, it's maybe more easy than any other nationality. But what in general excites people most, that it is sustainable, ecological friendly, affordable, and with a very large potential to make sustainable and continuous energy. So when we talk about sun and wind, that's beautiful, but you still need conversion and storage to make sure that whenever we do not use coal and gas or oil anymore, that we still have power available. And certainly in that comparison or that new energy mix, I think blue energy reverse electrodialysis can make a very nice contribution in an efficient new energy mix.
Because you're generating electricity constantly. You're not storing it. You're actually producing it continuously.
Yeah. It's a full continuous round the clock, 365 days a year, fully continuous.
As long as the fresh water is flowing into the sea.
Yeah. That's it.
So salinity gradient power is in its infancy, but it's once it moves beyond the pilot stage and is commercialized and upscaled, it's going to be very competitive.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. We have a bright future. The only thing we have to do is to convince the authorities and the power companies to take a decent look at our case.
And the sun doesn't need to shine and the wind doesn't need to blow.
Right. Yeah.
Peter Hack is co-founder and chair of RedStack. Link to RedStack at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. In the Canadian Arctic, vast expanses of tundra and sea ice are home to seabirds like common and king eiders. But as the climate warms and sea ice melts, some birds could struggle to find food in their usual places. And more shipping in the Arctic increases the risk of oil spills. So monitoring seabird colonies is critical. But Julia Bach of the Canadian Wildlife Service says remote, harsh conditions make that difficult.
A lot of these colonies are quite far away, sometimes, for example, a six-hour boat ride.
So some areas have not been surveyed in decades. And because the Arctic is changing so fast, a lot of existing data is outdated. For example, Bach recently conducted a survey of common eiders.
And we went at a time that we expected the birds would be present because of the previous data from the 1980s and 1990s. But when we got there, the sea ice was already broken up. And so the birds, normally concentrated in a crack in the sea ice feeding, could have been anywhere.
So Bach and her colleagues are compiling existing data so researchers know which areas and species have been studied and when. She hopes this helps them prioritize which areas to study in the future and guides conservation as the climate changes. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.